Good day. Welcome to another episode of the Audible Local Ledger Reads to the Blind podcast. You can get more information at audiblelocalledger.org. Stay tuned for today's reading.
Hi, my name's Eric. I'll be reading you selections from the e-edition of this week's Falmouth Enterprise. Today's date is Friday, June 2nd of 2023. The Falmouth Enterprise masthead says it's devoted to the interests of the Falmouth community. The headline above the fold, if there was such a thing, in a digital paper, federal grant puts homelessness nonprofit on track for property purchase. House likely under contract soon, by Kurt Aitchin. A major new infusion of federal and private funding may soon allow the Falmouth nonprofit, belonging to each other, to expand efforts to help the housing insecure with the group's first-ever property purchase. Representatives of the group signed documents with Barnstable County on Wednesday to receive $350,000 in federally appropriated pandemic relief funds under the ARPA, American Rescue Plan Act. Belonging to each other has also received a $300,000 community challenge gift from Linda Zammer, widow of restaurateur and philanthropist William Zammer Jr., a 2016 Falmouth Citizen of the Year who died in June of 2021. The grant was allocated by Barnstable County in a competitive process by which 120 applicants were whittled down to 20 recipients. The combined $650,000 puts the nonprofit at the halfway mark in a planned $1.3 million capital campaign that's aimed at buying a house in Falmouth and paying other expenses related to its long-term transitional housing program. The group has its eye on a specific property in town, but declined to provide details until it's under contract, something they're hoping will happen this week. I'm still pinching myself, belonging to each other, Executive Director Gina M. Torrielli said. We've been holding our breath, and now we're finally starting to breathe. A degree of uncertainty has surrounded the grant since a possible clawback of pandemic relief funds had been on the bargaining table during debt ceiling negotiations between President Joseph R. Biden Jr. and the Republican House majority. The two sides reached a deal which was passed by the House on Wednesday, and with signed paperwork at the county level, it appears pretty solid that the grant will be dispersed, Ms. Torrielli said. Belonging to each other is the only Falmouth-based and entirely Falmouth-focused nonprofit on the list of grant recipients. Its $350,000 grant is the fifth largest among the 20 on the list. The long-term transitional housing program is the centerpiece of Belonging to Each Other's outreach efforts to help Falmouth residents facing severe housing insecurity. People that come to us living on the beaches, living in the woods, sleeping out at the bus depot, we screen them. We interview them. They come into our houses, said Carol J. Greeley, the group's clinical program director. Up until now, the group has had on and off success to two rental houses with about 12 to 14 units to house people during 6 months of the year, including all winter, while they work on a longer-term life plan. Those efforts are complicated by the fact that owners of the houses may want or need to sell or rent out the houses for the summer. Case managing housing insecure individuals can also be a delicate matter. A lot of the folks that we have had a lot of trauma, or they've been outside over a long time, Ms. Torrielli said. Beyond providing simple shelter, Belonging to Each Other's six-month transition program is a coaching period on the day-to-day coping skills that are required to be in a home. That can range from tactical tips on household management to emotional and psychological health care. Keeping a house is difficult for people who haven't been living independently for a while, Ms. Greeley said. Sometimes they need just a little more case management. And this is an awesome opportunity for us because we do have people with significant mental illness. Belonging to Each Other's board had made the decision to acquire a property for the group even before the federal grant came through in order to provide a year-round, reduced liability environment in which to provide intensive case management and oversight of those the group seeks to transition into housing stability. The move is a response to an acute shortage of emergency and transitional housing on the Upper Cape. Falmouth has the second largest homeless population on the Cape, Ms. Torrielli said. And despite that, there's no emergency shelter in the whole Upper Cape. And there are very few beds for people with developmental disabilities, significant mental illness, trauma, or domestic violence, she said. Ms. Torrielli said the pandemic highlighted that imbalance of resources, as did last September's sale of the Eastman Hardware block on Main Street, in which upstairs tenants were ordered to vacate their apartments so they could be renovated. I think the people in Falmouth really care about the fact that we don't want this town to be completely expensive places to live, said Elise D. DeGroot, the nonprofit's director of development and community relations. Ms. DeGroot will now head up a comprehensive capital campaign that will begin with a so-called quiet, quote-unquote, fundraising round before turning to a more explicit public outreach once the group has raised 80% of its $1.3 million target, or just over $1 million. I think we should give a shout-out to our grant committee, she said, pointing out all the members are volunteers. A spirit of optimism pervades the tiny headquarters of the group, whose last federal grant was just $20,000 to buy a donated meals fridge and other emergency equipment. Belonging to Each Other plans to continue its other programs, such as emergency lodging in hotels for the housing insecure during winter cold snaps. But the $650,000 infusion is a point of inflection for the nonprofit's longer-range strategy. We have a lot of potential partners to work with, Ms. Torrielli said. This is going to be such a cool town project. The Zammer Gift. After Belonging to Each Other became a finalist for its federal grant, Linda Zammer was moved to pledge $300,000 to the group. I wanted to do it anonymously, she recalled. However, with a little persuading by the nonprofit's development director, Ms. DeGroot, she changed her mind and went public, offering the donation as a challenge gift. The Zammer name has resonance in terms of challenging the Falmouth community to acts of generosity. Linda and her late husband William Zammer owned Falmouth's Flying Bridge Restaurant in the Coonamuset Inn. They donated money, time, and energy extensively to charitable causes, especially any related to housing. Any type of housing he was involved in, Ms. Zimmer said. He thought we did too much talking about housing and not enough action. When Mr. Zammer encountered an unhoused person sleeping in the parking lot of the Coonamuset Inn one day, he got on the phone to Duffy Health Center in Hyannis. He always knew who to call, Ms. Zammer said. We did find that person housing. The Zammers also stepped up to find many of their employees housing. And Mr. Zammer was known to be seriously concerned with the dwindling supply of housing for people who work, quote-unquote, normal jobs. Mr. Zammer purchased the former Falmouth Hotel on Main Street in May of 2000, and following renovation, the building housed 56 of his employees in second and third floor apartments. It was a first-of-its-kind effort in town for which he received national media attention. The couple also worked with a housing assistance corporation to provide formerly homeless residents with free culinary arts training at the Cape Cod Community College Institute named after them. Their list of charitable engagements goes on, stacking up a long track record of generosity that can be potent in motivating others. There's kind of a halo effect, Ms. DeGroot said. If the Zammers think it's worthwhile to put their name on, then it must be worthwhile for me as well. They know it's going to happen, and it's an important thing. Our next headline on the cover of today's Falmouth Enterprise. This week's date is Friday, June 2nd of 2023. It's important because we will repeat this through the week. Residents consider changing Falmouth government by Noel Ananen. Residents gathered in the Morse Pond School Auditorium on Wednesday to learn about how they might possibly change Falmouth's municipal government structure. Falmouth resident Barbara P. Schneider, a town meeting member and the Beach Committee chairwoman, called for the informational session and organized the panel of town government experts. We've gone too many years without considering our options since we've changed so much as a community, Dr. Schneider wrote in the announcement of the event. As residents questioned the machinations of creating and implementing a new form of government, they revisited a subject that has been picked up and put back down again a handful of times since the Falmouth Home Rule Charter was approved by voters in 1990 and went into effect in 1991. The current charter calls for a representative town meeting, a town manager, and a 5-member select board. Residents didn't come to any decisions, but they did agree to meet and discuss the topic further at a later date. Dr. Schneider said the removal of former town manager Julian M. Suso by the select board prompted conversations on how Falmouth is run. But she scheduled the meeting after the May town election to prevent anyone from thinking it had anything to do with the select board candidates or the election. Panelist Michael Palmer, the Falmouth town clerk for more than 20 years, presented options for how Falmouth residents might begin the process of changing the charter and the structure of government. Mr. Palmer said residents can change their form of government in one of two ways, electing a charter commission or to request a special act of the legislature. Forming a charter commission requires signatures from 15% of registered Falmouth voters, currently about 3,500 signatures. Mr. Palmer said such a petition has been started once or twice since the 90s, but didn't get enough signatures. If one did, the select board would get the petition and then place the question of forming and electing 9 members to a commission on a municipal ballot. The Charter Commission would hold public hearings throughout the process of planning a new government. Should it come up with amendments or a total revision of the town charter, the commission would submit a preliminary report to the Attorney General's office within 18 months of forming. And once approved by that office, the report would come back to be placed on the ballot after 60 days. Mr. Palmer confirmed that while the select board is the authority for placing items on a ballot, it doesn't have the authority to prevent a charter commission's recommendations from going to the voters for approval. Those recommendations would not need to pass through town meeting. A special act of the legislature is the alternative to a charter commission. A special act would be written and submitted to town meeting as a warrant article. A warrant article can go on the ballot as a citizen's petition, which only needs 10 signatures. Town meeting would then discuss and vote on the article. If it's approved, the article would then go to the state legislature. Representatives would discuss and vote on the article. If the article included specific language stating that the charter changes contained within must be approved by the whole town in an election, the legislature would send the article back to the Falmouth ballots for final approval. If not, the state legislature would be the final approving authority for that charter change. Mr. Palmer said through the special act or commission, the town can essentially do as it wants, regardless of the town's population or size. Falmouth can mix and match executive positions and legislative bodies and, to a certain extent, their responsibilities. For example, Falmouth could have an elected mayor and a town meeting. Or it could elect a town council that would elect a mayor and not have a town meeting. You can be as creative as you want, Mr. Palmer said. Dr. Schneider said State Representative David T. Vieira told her that Falmouth can determine where government weaknesses are and invent solutions as it sees fit. Falmouth has been flexible and creative in the past, and they can do that going forward, Dr. Schneider said. Attendees questioned Mr. Palmer and the 3 other panelists on the differences between town managers and mayors and boards and councils, the history behind Falmouth's current charter, and the authorities over any charter changes. The 3 other panelists all have experience in municipal government and charter transitions. Troy Clarkson is the chief financial officer in Brockton and a former Falmouth Select Board member. Joseph C. Sullivan was the first mayor of Braintree. Warren J. Rutherford was the first town manager for Barnstable. Mr. Rutherford said he was a new town manager in the 1990s during a transition between charters. He said there were some major changes and major oversights during the transition, but those details were handled once his office caught on to them. One attendee asked if transitioning between charters is expensive. Mr. Rutherford said no, it doesn't add cost to the town budget simply to transition between charters. If the charter revisions call for a consultant, new staff, or additional capital projects, then those costs would be added to the budget. Residents can tweak any details of government management however they want, but they should consider why they make any given change. If it's not better than what you have now, Then why change? Mr. Rutherford said. He added, a charter commission might hire a consultant to assist it through the process. Mr. Rutherford said Barnstable doesn't have a town meeting, but Falmouth might want to consider keeping its own town meeting, even if it changes the structure or responsibilities. If there's an interest in residents being more involved, give them that opportunity, Mr. Rutherford said. Mr. Sullivan said that as the first mayor of Braintree, a position he held for 12 years, he was responsible for hiring and removing each department head as he saw fit. He said his overarching authority allowed him to be nimble in his position, and he was able to respond quickly to events such as harsh weather and others. He suggested the town self-examine throughout any charter changes. There are more critiques than compliments, Mr. Sullivan said, but the work is so meaningful and it's important. Mr. Palmer said in a phone call yesterday that meetings to consider the structure of town government have been held periodically throughout his tenure as clerk. It's never gone anywhere, Mr. Palmer said, and it hasn't gone anywhere yet. Dr. Schneider called for a show of hands to gauge interest in a future meeting for further discussion. Nearly all the roughly 50 attendees raised their hands. Dr. Schneider also pointed out that anyone interested in learning about the discussions that led to Falmouth's current charter can read about them in Enterprise articles in the library's database. Relevant articles ran between 1988 and 1991. The next headline on the front page of the Falmouth Enterprise, dated Friday, June 2nd of 2023, reads, Chompy's Big Day. Students explore Kunamiset River by Gilda Geist. Wednesday marked the first fifth grade field trip to the Kunamiset River restoration site for Morse Pond School students. Plans are for the trip to become an annual event. How many of you came on the field trip last year? Kunamiset River Trust President Wendy B. Buesler asked. Nearly everyone raised their hands. Visiting the Kunamiset River has been a fourth grade tradition in the Falmouth schools for several years. The fourth graders get a tour and they learn about the restoration of the lower river, an effort which culminated in 2020. Now, for the first time, students are coming back to the site as fifth graders. The students learn how to assess the health of the river to determine if the restoration efforts they learned about last year are working. The field trip started with a brief presentation from Ms. Buesler. Enthusiasm and energy ran low until an osprey carrying a large stick in its claws flew by, capturing the attention of all 45 students. The students then broke into five smaller groups led by teachers and volunteers. Retired Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution chemist Ann McNichol and HUI graduate student Serena Sung Clark were among the volunteers, using their expertise to help the students complete water chemistry experiments, and identify macroinvertebrates. Carmela Majeski, who's in charge of organizing scientific field trips for the Falmouth schools, said she tries to recruit a diverse group of volunteers so that students see that all types of people can be scientists, regardless of age, race, or gender. For the students, the highlight of the trip was wading through the river. Some students brought shoes they could get wet. Others took turns wearing waders that were provided by their group leaders. You two do not have the best reputation with balance, special education teacher Lily A. Peterson playfully warned two girls as they prepared to get into the water. It's slippery, so don't step on the green stuff. In their oversized boots that were borrowed from Ms. Buesler's husband, the two girls carefully waded into the water before Ms. Peterson passed them each a net. Oh my God, I found stuff! One girl shouted with excitement as she pulled her net from the water. A volunteer helped the student identify some of the creatures in her net, including a leech. Then came the cries of, Ew! And let's show Ms. Peterson. They found a leech! A student from another group reported to his classmates, I want to see a leech. But the biggest hit of the day was the sighting of a dinner plate-sized snapping turtle. Ms. Peterson pointed it out to one student who quickly spread the word. I found a snapping turtle, he told his group, and it looks like a rock. Within minutes, the news traveled down the river to the other groups, and the students bestowed the turtle with the name Chompy. Identifying creatures that live in the water can help students figure out how clean the water is, Ms. Majeski explained. That day, students also tested the water's levels of pH, phosphate, dissolved oxygen, nitrate, and turbidity. Then students used all that information to make a determination about the health of the river. As Ms. Majewski sees it, these field trips are designed to teach all Thalmas students the importance of preserving their local environment. Not all kids have family members who can bring them to a natural space like this, she said. At the end of the two-hour trip, the students checked for ticks and then piled back onto the bus. Final story on the cover of this week's Falmouth Enterprise, Pickleball Complainants Ready for Compromise by Noelle Annanen. Plaintiffs in a court proceeding over pickleball courts at the Lawrence School in Falmouth are wearying, but not tapping out, of the nearly three-year-long battle for the game to cease at the school. The Lawrence courts, which accommodate both tennis and pickleball, are now under lock and key as a precaution against potential pickleball players. But a compromise might be on the horizon. Neighbors of the courts on Lakeview Avenue say the repetitive, sharp sound of the pickleball meeting the paddle is nearly intolerable. They filed an injunction against pickleball being played, which was issued on October 6th. Last month, town council advised that the courts be closed entirely, both to tennis and pickleball players, to prevent any skirting of the court order. But plaintiffs in the case might be willing to compromise with the town after a year and a half of court proceedings, said their attorney, Jonathan Poloni of Senny & Associates PE. Mr. Poloni said his clients would agree to a two-year lift of the injunction against pickleball games, providing the town enforces vigorously its pre-existing restrictions on the days and hours pickleball can be played, which were often ignored. Pickleball could play tomorrow, Mr. Poloni said. Prior to the injunction, pickleball was allowed only on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. However, the intention is only to allow the game temporarily as a means of buying the time to construct new pickleball courts elsewhere. At the end of the 2 years, Mr. Poloni said, his clients would want the pickleball courts at the school to close permanently. Short of a resolution of this kind, Mr. Poloni said, the plaintiffs are willing to go to trial. This is their lives, Mr. Poloni said. This is what they have to live with. They don't feel like they have an alternative. Pickleball draws eager players to Falmouth's four designated pickleball courts in the Gus Canty Community Center. Recreation Director Joe Olenek said, players standing by on wait lists for court time still show up in case they get a chance to play. They just love it, and they want to play every day, Mr. Olenek said. His department fields frequent phone calls from residents wondering when new courts will open. Four more courts are slated for construction at Nye Park in North Falmouth, and in November the town approved $220,000 for the design of additional courts at Trotting Park. In 2020 and 2021, residents of neighboring properties on Lakeview Avenue appealed to town officials, the Recreation Committee, and the Zoning Board of Appeals for altered hours of play, or the pickleball stop altogether at the Lawrence School. They claim pickleball caused injurious noise from the game being played as close as 40 feet away from some of their homes. That repetitive sound, it's sharp and piercing, is interfering with people's lives, Mr. Poloni said. He said his clients stay inside with windows closed and even wear noise-canceling headphones. The ZBA denied relief from the noise under Falmouth's noise nuisance bylaw in December of 2021. Plaintiffs then pursued court action against the ZBA in Barnstable Superior Court in January of 2022. It got to a court case because we weren't being listened to, said Michael B. Galasso, one of the six plaintiffs. While the injunction is only against pickleball, an email from town council in May stated that even if the town allowed only tennis to be played at the courts, pickleball players would likely arrive and play their game regardless, leaving the town in violation of the injunction and subject to a fine, which he guessed would be around $5,000. People just show up whenever they want to play pickleball, Mr. Poloni said. It's clear the rules aren't being followed by the pickleball community. The Recreation Committee discussed leaving the courts open for tennis players only, but ultimately they opted to follow town council's advice. Mr. Galasso said tennis is much quieter than pickleball, and that was never a problem for himself or the other neighbors. That the injunction also shut down tennis is not something we had in mind, he said. The court case is dragged on because no one can find a solution they agree on, Mr. Galasso said. While the proposal of building a sound barrier of some kind once made it as far as town meeting, it was struck down by voters, largely because neighbors thought barriers wouldn't actually mitigate the noise and maintained that pickleball should simply not be played. Mr. Galasso is suggesting the Recreation Committee form a subcommittee and sit down with the plaintiffs, the recreation director, and others who are involved to find a solution to the problem without attorneys present. While the Recreation Committee didn't take any action on that request since the case is ongoing, Mr. Galasso said he reached out to interim town manager Peter Johnson Staub to determine if a solution can be reached outside of court. Now is the time for us to sit down and talk, Mr. Galasso said. Mr. Johnson Staub said in an email on Wednesday that he is scheduling a meeting with plaintiffs without attorneys present. Mr. Poloni said the case currently remains in the discovery phase and a pretrial conference is scheduled for October 13th. As I mentioned, I'm reading you the Falmouth Enterprise dated Friday, June 2nd of 2023, and it will be repeated throughout the week. So it's always fun to look back and see if the weather forecast was correct for this coming weekend. This afternoon, it'll be mostly sunny. Night, it will be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers and thunderstorms, and then showers likely and possibly a thunderstorm. So rain tonight and possibly tomorrow. The high will be 71, the low will be 52 today. Tomorrow during the day, it'll be cloudy with showers likely and possibly a thunderstorm across the Cape and Islands. The high will be 55, and at night, it'll be mostly cloudy with showers likely. The low will be around 51. Extended forecast for Sunday calls for mostly cloudy with showers likely during the day. At night, it'll be mostly cloudy with a chance of showers. Highs on Sunday will be 58 with a low of 52. We'll see how accurate that is. From the police log, on Thursday, May 25th at 6:46 p.m., two cars crashed on Tanglewood Drive and responding officers found both the driver and passenger in one vehicle were overdosing. Bystanders were giving the victims CPR and provided naloxone to the officers, which they administered. Officers took over CPR. They were able to revive the victims. They were placed in protective custody and transported to Falmouth Hospital. The driver, a 49-year-old Falmouth man, was charged with operating under the influence of drugs, negligent operation of a motor vehicle, and a marked lanes violation. East Falmouth Elementary Principal hired. Kelty Kelly has been appointed as the new principal of East Falmouth Elementary School effective July 1st. She's currently the principal of FX O'Regan Early Childhood Development Center in Franklin. Ms. Kelly has more than 30 years of experience in education committed to ensuring all children have access to high-quality educational opportunities. She's experienced in curriculum review and social-emotional learning and has taught and led early childhood and special education within the public schools. She's a graduate of Boston College, received her master's degree in education leadership from Framingham State College. Her strong collaboration skills will be an asset to the entire school community, Falmouth Public Schools Superintendent Lori Dewar said in a news release. She's proven to be an advocate for all children, and we are excited she'll be joining the administrative team of the Falmouth Public Schools. Ms. Kelly will be taking over the leadership of East Falmouth Elementary from Paul Goodhind, who will retire at the end of this school year. There are several meetings scheduled for next week. On Monday, the Water Quality Management Committee will meet at 4:30 p.m. at the Falmouth Public Library. The Board of Health will meet on Monday at 5:30 p.m. at the Town Hall. The Select Board will meet Monday at 6:30 p.m. at the Town Hall. The Historical Commission will meet Tuesday at 6 p.m. at the Town Hall. The Solid Waste Advisory Committee will meet Tuesday at 7 p.m. at the Town Hall. The Agricultural Commission will meet Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. at the Town Hall. The Affirmative Action Diversity Committee will meet Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Town Hall. The Bicycle and Pedestrian Committee will meet Wednesday at 7 p.m. via Zoom. The Conservation Commission will meet Wednesday at 7 p.m. via Zoom. The Waterways Committee will meet Wednesday at 7 p.m. via Zoom. The Affordable Housing Committee will meet Thursday at 5:30 p.m. in the town hall, and the Zoning Board of Appeals will meet Thursday at 6:30 p.m. in the town hall. We're at the midway portion of our reading. Regular listeners, I'm sure, are aware it's at this stage in the reading when we move to the different kind of local news, which is the death notices and the obituaries. In today's Falmouth Enterprise, dated Friday, June 2nd of 2023, the first obituary is of Thomas G. Larkin of North Falmouth, a veteran, entrepreneur, and athlete who passed on May 23rd at the age of 86. He was born in Boston to Irish immigrants and grew up in a little house in Oak Square in Brighton. He attended Our Lady of the Presentation Academy, where the nuns, who disapproved of his left-handedness, coerced him into ambidexterity. And as he did with every challenge, Mr. Larkin leveraged that ambidexterity later in life to become a formidable tennis competitor on the national level. In 1954, he graduated from Boston College High School, where he ran track. At 18, he won a Golden Gloves boxing title. He continued as a middleweight at Boston College, graduating in 1958 with a degree in economics. Some of Mr. Larkin's favorite years were spent in the U.S. Marine Corps. Thank you for your service, Mr. Larkin. He opened the world to him and introduced him to what would become his lifelong passion, tennis. He achieved the rank of captain and was aboard the USS Iwo Jima with the first landing team as the U.S. teetered on the brink of war during the Cuban Missile Crisis. He returned home, improved his tennis, and met Ann Sullivan. The pair married, started a family. In 1971, they founded a business, Yankee Tape Company, which paid the bills and put three children through college. The Larkins moved to Falmouth in 2000. In retirement, Mr. Larkin became certified as a tennis pro and taught at King's Grant Racquet Club in Barnstable. In addition to his wife of 60 years, Mr. Larkin leaves family and friends. Services were held on June 1st. The next obituary is of Patricia L. Wallace of Falmouth, who passed May 30th at the age of 77. Patricia was born in Quincy and raised in Norwell. She was a 1964 graduate of Norwell High School, and she worked as a cosmetologist and started her career in Boston, where she met Robert P. Wallace. They welcomed three children and moved to the Cape to raise them. A graveside service will be held this Monday, June 5th, at 10 a.m. at the Massachusetts National Cemetery in Bourne. The next obituaries of Catherine Norcott of Falmouth, a leader in the financial services industry and an elite athlete who passed unexpectedly on May 20th at the age of 65. She was born in Brookline and worked for more than 30 years in the financial services industry, holding senior management positions at State Street Global Markets and Bank Boston. From 2016 until her death, she worked as a certified financial planner and a realtor. Services were held May 27th in Falmouth. The next obituary is of Laura A. Walsh of Falmouth, who died on May 15th at the age of 63. Laura was born in Boston and raised in Hingham, graduating from Hingham High School in 1977. She was an artist and storyteller, weaving rugs and stories whenever she could. She started a food pantry in Lincoln that's still in operation today and facilitated a clothing and blanket drive for the homeless in Falmouth in 2022. She spent the last several years of her life in Falmouth enjoying the outdoors and her community here. A graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. on Saturday, June 17th at St. Paul Cemetery in Hingham. The next obituary is of John E. Simonis of East Falmouth, a U.S. Army veteran and deacon at St. Patrick's Catholic Church, who died on May 25th at the age of 76. John was born in Brockton and was raised in Whitman, moving to Falmouth 40 years ago. He worked in the marine industry at Harry Miller Boatyard in Boston, McDougal's Cape Cod Marine Service, and Edwards Boatyard in East Falmouth, from which he retired. In the late 1990s, Mr. Simonis began studying for the deaconate in the Diocese of Fall River. He served as deacon at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Falmouth for the past 20 years. He leaves his wife of 54 years, Elizabeth Simonis, and many who will miss him dearly. Services were held June 1st in Falmouth. The next obituaries of Murtis Chatfield of Pocasset, who passed on February 2nd at the age of 95. A celebration of life will be held at 10 a.m. on Saturday, June 24th, at the North Falmouth Congregational Church, 155 Old Main Street in North Falmouth. The next obituaries of Richard Quinlan of East Falmouth, who passed at the age of 84 on May 22nd. Richard was born in Boston and raised in Jamaica Plain as the youngest of nine children. He graduated from Jamaica Plain High School and worked for the MBTA until his retirement. He loved Falmouth and enjoyed Chappaqua Beach and singing with a group of male friends around the piano at the Old Nimrod every Saturday night. No services are planned. The next obituary is of Lorraine L. Burtis of Mashpee, the former operations chief at Little River Boatyard, who passed at the age of 71 on May 25th. She was a 1969 graduate of Lawrence High School. Ms. Burtis worked in several jobs until her family took over Little River Boatyard on Secaucet Island in Mashpee. She then ran day-to-day operations for many years. She enjoyed all animals, especially cats, the beach, gardening, music, and football. She was best known for her infectious smile and contagious laugh. She leaves her husband of 52 years, Jonathan Burtis, her daughter, Jennifer Zielinski of Mashpee, two grandsons, and extended family. A funeral mass will be celebrated at 10 a.m. on Wednesday, June 7th at St. Anthony's Catholic Church in East Falmouth. With the death notices, the following residents, former residents, or family of residents of Mashpee, born and sandwich recently passed. John A. Chilingarian, 72 years old of Mashpee, died May 5th. Kenneth G. Clark, Jr., 89 years old of Pocahontas, Arkansas, died May 26th. Janice H. Doria, 84 of Mashpee, died on May 11th. Vivian A. Gosnell, 88 of Sandwich, died May 5th. Lawrence M. Hagar, 89 of Sandwich, died on May 11th. G. Herbert Johnson Jr., 92 of Hudson, died May 21st. John F. Kahane, 87 of East Sandwich, died May 27th. Annette Oakley, 40 of Manchester, Connecticut, died May 26th. Eric A. Sobolewski, 52 of East Sandwich, died on May 24th, and Frank Y. Sorensen, 85 years old of Forestdale, died on May 25th. That concludes the obituaries in the Falmouth Enterprise dated Friday, June 2nd of 2023. From the editorial board, we don't really read letters or opinion pieces, but the editorial board of the Falmouth Enterprise represents the Falmouth Enterprise's take on many subjects, so we try to read that as much as possible. The headline is "An Absurd Effort to Roll Back Gun Laws." The National Association for Gun Rights has filed suit in U.S. District Court seeking to overturn the state's limited ban on semi-automatic firearms, such as AK-47s, Uzis, and MAC-10 rifles. "Deadly assault weapons have no place in Massachusetts," said then-Governor Mitt Romney when he signed the ban into law in 1998. "These guns aren't made for recreation or self-defense. They're instruments of destruction with the sole purpose of hunting down and killing people. We agree. These weapons are not for sport. They're not for hunting. They're assault rifles, designed to do as much damage as quickly as possible." The 1998 ban was a step in the right direction in an effort to keep these guns off the streets, but it was only one step. It's a step that should be built upon, not torn down. It would be appalling if this little bit of progress was erased from the books. The association's lawsuit argues the Massachusetts gun ban is in violation of the 2022 Supreme Court decision handed down in the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association versus Bruin case, which stated gun control laws must find their justification in the history, text, and tradition of the Second Amendment. Hearings in the case began Tuesday. Massachusetts has been directly violating the Second Amendment for decades, Dudley Brown, president of the National Association for Gun Rights, wrote in a press release about the lawsuit. This law bans firearms that are in common use throughout the United States, including the most popular rifle in America. Our members are chomping at the bit to snuff out semi-automatic bans nationwide, and taking a hatchet to the Romney gun ban will be a tremendous feather in our cap. The Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution states a well-regulated militia, being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. The Second Amendment, like other constitutional rights, doesn't grant absolute and unlimited protection. Courts have recognized the government's interest in maintaining public safety and have applied a balancing test to determine the constitutionality of gun control measures. The question is whether the regulation or ban is a reasonable restriction that still allows for the exercise of the right to bear arms while also serving a compelling public interest. We believe the state's ban on semi-automatic weapons is a reasonable restriction aimed to balance public safety with individual rights. Assault weapons have no place in our homes or in the hands of civilians. Even before the latest shootings this week, the United States was on track to set a record this year for mass killings, with an average of more than one mass killing each week. These shootings have occurred at shopping malls, schools, and parties, and in countless neighborhoods all across the country. We hope the U.S. District Court judge in this case sees that it is not the time to be rolling back the state's gun laws. It's the time to uphold them, even strengthen them. And here is the Select Board agenda. At 6 o'clock, open session. This is for Monday, June 5th, for the Select Board agenda. At 6 o'clock, open session, call to order and pledge of allegiance. 6:05, committee interviews and appointments. Interview, vote, and appoint committee members. Plastic Reduction Advisory Committee, 7 members. And that will be Amy Roth, Board of Health member, Christine Copley, Solid Waste Advisory Committee member, Joshua Flanders, Food Establishment, Michael Lewis, Food Establishment, Stephen Vanerson, Food Establishment, Geraldine Shad, Stephanie Murphy, Philip Gessen, and Daniel Gessen. Regulatory Boards, Board of Health, Amy Roth and Kevin Kroger, Conservation Commission, Stephen Patton, Zoning Board of Appeals, Frank Duffy and Anthony Petrucci. Non-Regulatory Boards, Affordable Housing Committee, Samuel Patterson. Bicycle and Pedestrian Committee, Paul Joyce, Matthew Delaney, and Ellen Adams. The Commission on Substance Use, Dennis Lyons. EDIC, Samuel Patterson. Solid Waste Advisory Committee, Robert Garrett. South Cape Beach Advisory Committee, Debbie Scott. Water Quality Management Committee, Ronald Zweig, John Waterbury, and Edward Jelowiczyk. Committee reappointments on uncontested seats at 6:35 p.m. Open session. Proclamation, Day of Portugal, June 10th of 2023. Recognition, Michael Galasso, EDIC, Emergency Communication Officers, then announcements and public comment. At 6:45 p.m., the public hearings will begin. Application for a transfer of an all-alcoholic beverages restaurant license by Peppercorn Restaurant located at 285 Main Street in Falmouth. An application for a common victualler license has also been submitted. Number 2, application for a transfer of an all-alcoholic beverages restaurant license by RGMD Corp. doing business as Ristorante Avellino, located at 339 East Falmouth Highway, East Falmouth. An application for a common victualler license has also been submitted. At 7:05 p.m., business. Number 1, affirm the police chief appointment. Number 2, acting as trustees of the Falmouth Affordable Housing Fund, vote to grant $177,293.96 to Megancet Crossing, LLC to supplement funding for 10 affordable, deed-restricted rental units at Megancet Crossing. Number 3, the annual report from the Conservation Commission. Number 4, presentation and vote to send a letter to the EPA regarding machine gun range at Joint Base Cape Cod. Number 5, approve a request from Cape Cod Guangping Taiji Quan Club for a waiver of the special event permit fee for the Taiji practice at Marine Park on Saturday mornings from June 10th from June 10th, I can't tell, there's a typo, to another day in 2023. Number six, request for variance to sign code 184-32 off-premise signs, Falmouth Art Market on Tuesdays, 6/27/23 to 8/29/23. And number seven, review of select board liaison assignments. At 8 o'clock p.m., they'll take on the consent agenda. Number one, licenses. Approve the application for an automatic amusement device license for Shipwrecked LLC, doing business as Shipwrecked, located at 263 Grand Avenue in Falmouth. Number two, administrative orders. Vote to approve letter of interest in applying for ownership of Nobska Lighthouse property. B. Approve letter to Steamship Authority regarding early morning ferry schedule. C. Request for variance to sign code, off-premise signs, Rotary Club of Falmouth, day of play Saturday, July 8th of 23. And D, request for variance to sign code, off-premise signs, Rotary Club of Falmouth, Butterfly Garden Day, on Saturday, August 5th of 23. At 8:05 p.m., they'll read the minutes, review and vote to approve the minutes of meetings, public session, May 22nd of 23, and executive session of April 3rd of 23. At 8:10 p.m., the town manager's supplemental report. At 8:15 p.m., select board reports. 8:25 p.m., discussion of future agenda items. And at 8:35 p.m., they are hoping to adjourn. Town considers even higher water rate increase for Main Project by Noel Annanen. The town is considering raising water rates by at least 52% to fund a water main replacement project anticipated to cost $3 million each year. The total estimated cost of the replacement project, excluding inflation factors, is $49 million, according to a consultant. The water department's not currently fully funded by revenue from water bills and is being subsidized by other town funds, Finance Director Ed Centeo told the Select Board on May 22nd. Staff gave the Select Board two options for increasing the water rates to cover the cost of the project. Either the town can increase water rates by 77.5% to fully fund the water department and also the water main replacement, or it can continue to subsidize the water department and increase rates by 52% to only cover the water main project. At the previous meeting in April, staff said rates would need to increase by 42%. Well, that number was based on 2016 numbers, which have since been updated, according to Mr. Centeo's presentation. The recommendation includes changing the water rate structure to a tiered low-to-high user fee structure. This ensures that municipal water consumers are only paying for what they use. Mr. Centeo will present specifics on how an average water user's bill will be impacted in a future Select Board meeting. Woods Hole scientists to study water circulation in Cape Cod Bay. Data could inform decision to dump or not radioactive waste in the bay by Gilda Geist. A Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution study of water pathways and circulation in Cape Cod Bay is slated to begin July 1st. The purpose of the study is to figure out where the 1.1 million gallons of radioactive wastewater from Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station would go if the water gets released into Cape Cod Bay, as has been proposed by the plant's decommissioning company, Holtec International. Rapid response funding for this one-year study is in the final stages of approval, Hui Senior Scientist and Director of Woods Hole Sea Grant, Matthew A. Charette, said. We were keen to let regulators know that this study was in the process of being funded and could provide potentially valuable information in their decision-making process on any permits that might be under consideration for release of radioactive wastewater to Cape Cod Bay, Dr. Charette said. Back in March, Dr. Charette met with U.S. Senator Edward J. Markey and Congressman William R. Keating to talk about what Woods Hole Sea Grant could do to provide more information on this proposed wastewater release. This is really right up our alley, he said. We fund research on issues of importance to Massachusetts coastal communities. This is certainly one of those issues. Many residents and policymakers are concerned about the potential impact of the proposed wastewater discharge on public health, fishing, aquaculture, and tourism. Currently, Holtec is waiting to hear back from regulators on whether it can get a modified permit that would authorize the wastewater discharge into Cape Cod Bay. Last week, the state Senate passed a piece of legislation written by State Senator Susan L. Moran, who's a Democrat from Falmouth, that would prohibit the State Department of Environmental Protection from granting the permit in question until a comprehensive study of the potential impacts of the wastewater is done. HUI has already done some preliminary work on mapping water pathways in Cape Cod Bay using data from a fleet of 400 drifting buoys. Physical oceanographer and lead scientist on the study, Irina I. Rapina, said. The buoys are oceanographic instruments that follow the movement of water, and they transmit their positions using the GPS, Dr. Rapina said. By getting their trajectories, we also get information about how the water is moving around. Using this information, Dr. Rapina and her team can find what's called the most likely pathway of water in Cape Cod Bay. But because the number of the drifting buoys is very limited, there are a lot of open questions that we can't address with this available data set, she said. Dr. Rapina and her team want to be able to figure out the time variability of the circulation of currents, as well as the main physical drivers of movement in the bay that might help explain that variability. And the way we plan to do this is using a high-resolution ocean circulation model, she said. Understanding the pathways that waters take throughout Cape Cod Bay will help scientists and regulators better predict the potential impacts of a wastewater release. At least some of the radionuclides move with the water, Dr. Rapina explained, and so understanding the circulation and transport of water also helps us understand the transport of radionuclides. This information will be useful to more than just regulators, Dr. Charette said. The aquaculture community, he said, is curious to know how such a release might impact their operations and their business. This model would be able to tell those individuals approximately when and where a wastewater plume might arrive at their farms. In terms of salt marsh and inlet health along the northern coast of Cape Cod, the study will be able to provide general information about how the wastewater might impact those areas, but not specifics. We will not be able to resolve all the details of the local circulation in and around all of those inlets, Dr. Rapina said. But on a larger scale, yes, we can predict whether the plume would pass through those locations and at what time scale. The study results will also have a practical application beyond the Pilgrim Nuclear Power Station wastewater. It'll help us understand movement of things like marine pollution or marine microplastics. It applies to harmful algal blooms, possible oil spills, Dr. Rapina said. It has tons of different applications. Funding for the study will come from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Sea Grant Program, and HUI will co-fund the study as well. Dog Beach, Not Coming to Falmouth by Gilda Geist. In a recent Falmouth Dog Park Board meeting, residents called for a designated area for dogs to run off-leash on one of Falmouth's beaches. In Falmouth, dogs aren't allowed on town beaches off-leash and not allowed on town beaches at all from May 1st to October 1st. These laws are part of the town charter, president of the Dog Park Board, Barbara P. Schneider, said. As a result, a dog park at a beach wouldn't be legal. Dr. Schneider said there are only two ways there could be a dog park at a Falmouth beach. One is if someone in town offers up their private property for use as a dog beach. The other is if the town charter is changed, which is a long and complicated process, Dr. Schneider said. Despite being against the rules, dogs are frequently off-leash on town beaches and conservation lands. Residents express various opinions about this, with some calling for more robust enforcement and others arguing for leniency and letting the dogs run free. Dr. Schneider recommended that those interested in changing the town charter should contact State Representative David T. Vieira, a Republican and a representative of the 3rd Barnstable District. with some police briefs on Thursday, May 25th. At 12.09 p.m., two cars crashed at the Sandwich Road and Brick Kiln Road intersection. One passenger was transported to the hospital with non-life-threatening injury. One of the drivers, a 20-year-old Falmouth man, was cited for using an electronic device while operating a motor vehicle and following too closely. One car required a tow. Get off your cell phones, people. It's almost always young people looking down while they're driving. Stupid. 1:42 p.m., officers issued an involuntary committal for substance abuse warrant of apprehension, or a Section 35, to a patient at Falmouth Hospital. The patient was then transported to Falmouth District Court for an evaluation. On Friday, May 26th, at 7:58 a.m., a 37-year-old Mashpee woman was found passed out in her car, which was parked in the Admiralty Inn. Officers spoke with her and arranged for a transport to the hospital for a mental health evaluation and treatment. At 11:28 a.m. on Friday, May 26th, officers arrested a 67-year-old Falmouth woman at her house for an outstanding warrant issued out of the Falmouth District Court. She was taken into custody and to the courthouse without incident. At 3:37 p.m., a man was slumped over outside the Cape Cod Cooperative Bank on Worcester Court. Officers found he was illegally possessing drugs and arrested 34-year-old Andrew Darby from Sandwich. On Saturday, May 27th, at 7:39 a.m., a car hit and seriously injured a deer on Route 28 South. An officer shot the deer because of its injuries. The car that hit the deer couldn't be found. At 7:40 p.m., two men were under the influence of drugs or alcohol at Garrett's Market. One of the men, 30-year-old Michael Gabriel from Falmouth, was arrested for two outstanding arrest warrants issued from Wrentham District Court without incident. The other, a 27-year-old Quincy man, began threatening the police and fire personnel who responded. He made suicidal statements and was taken to the hospital by the Falmouth Fire Rescue Department for a mental health evaluation. He'll also be summoned to court on charges of assault on ambulance personnel, disorderly conduct, and three counts of intimidating a witness. On Monday, May 29th at 10:08 a.m., a car crashed into a utility pole on Menahant Road and Mara Vista Avenue. The driver refused medical transport. The utility pole was broken, leaving wires in the road. Officers closed Menahant Road while the car was towed, and Eversource crews responded for repairs. On Tuesday, May 30th at 12:46 a.m., an officer stopped a car on Palmer Avenue after watching the driver speed and then hit a curb. The officer conducted an OUI investigation, which resulted in 25-year-old Jake Paramba from Falmouth being placed under arrest for OUI and negligent operation of a motor vehicle, a marked lanes violation, and speeding. Finally, at 10:28 p.m., a fight broke out at the East End Tap. Officers investigated the scene and arrested 50-year-old Scott McCullough from Falmouth for assault and battery with a dangerous weapon and disturbing the peace. And we'll take something from the arts section, arts, culture, living, and sports. Alex Torres and his Latin Orchestra returns to Mashpee with school and community performances by Joanne Brianna Gartner. Alex Torres and his Latin Orchestra will return to Mashpee Middle High School after a successful first visit last year to work and perform with the students and also to perform out in the community. Last year's visit was described by many as the best cultural education program we've hosted at the school, World Language Department Chairman Timothy Rumberger said. Staff and students and visitors described it as pure joy. Mr. Torres and his orchestra will participate in a two-day arts and education residency at Mashpee Middle High School, where they'll conduct workshops with music students and then perform and teach in an interactive assembly for the whole school. On Friday, June 9th at 6 p.m., the group will present a free community concert at the Mashpee Commons Band Shell on the Mashpee Library side of the Commons. The audience is welcome to bring their own lawn chairs or blankets or to slip into dancing shoes for what Mr. Rumberger calls a spicy start to summer. For adults who can't get enough of the band's Afro-Caribbean sounds, they'll be performing at an outdoor salsa dance party from 7 to 9 p.m. on Saturday, June 10th at Cape Cod Beer in Hyannis. Tickets can be purchased through Eventbrite. A similar event last year sold out. And with that, we've come to the end of our reading of the Falmouth Enterprise dated Friday, June 2nd of 2023. This is your reader, Eric, saying be well, be safe, look after each other. Remember the veterans, not just on Memorial Day. Bye for now.